Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
As we heard in the last segment, it is that time of year, time for New Year's resolutions. And after weeks of unbridled holiday culinary indulgence, maybe shedding a few pounds is right up there on your list of 2012 resolutions. But before you start, can I offer you just one last little taste of decadence?
Basically, you have a stiff jelly and you have liquid from powdered almonds that have been strained and strained. And normally sugar would be added. And he said, oh, you could put in some cochineal, which is powdered red beetles.
Yum! Well, it turns out the beetles are optional for this slightly modernized, circa 1710 version of a 14th century blancmange. Saffron can be substituted, or, for persons of refinement, no colorant at all. That, according to the cookbook Royal Cookery, or The Complete Court Cook.
And it's by Patrick Lamb, who claimed to be near 50 years master cook to their late majesties, King Charles II, King James II, King William and Queen Mary, and Queen Anne.
Barbara Ketchum Wheaton is the honorary curator of the culinary collection at the Radcliffe Institute's Schlesinger Library. The library is home to one of the world's most outstanding collections of historical cookbooks, including its most famous possession, the papers, recipes, and cookbooks of Julia and Paul Child. The cookbooks span more than 500 years and almost as many cultures. Marilyn Altieri, curator of printed material at the Schlesinger, says the collection found its home at Radcliffe in the 1960s, after Harvard University's Widener Library decided to move the cookbooks, thinking they were materials better suited for a place devoted to documenting women's history.
It was not exactly received with open arms. There were many feminists involved with the library who thought that cooking was something they wanted to leave behind.
It was the 1960s, after all. But it was quickly realized that these are not just books about cooking. They are historical treasure troves. Food is a rare cultural nexus, connecting information about the economy, climate, technology, even levels of education among people living in a particular place and time. As I found out when I took a tour of the Schlesinger collection with Marilyn Altieri and Barbara Ketchum Wheaton, the cookbooks even document the impact of social upheaval and of war.
You'll find them, for example, in World War I from Germany and France and England, as well as the United States. And everybody is adjusting. And even post-war England, the cookbooks that tell you what to do with your week's egg, using the white on one day and the yolk on another.
Because they were rationing food.
Because eggs were rationed.
Here is a classic French cookbook, La Cuisinière Bourgeoise, which was first published in 1746 and republished every year between 1746 and 1853. It's even appeared in the years of the French Revolution and the Terror in Paris. Annual editions were still coming out. This is a cookbook, one of the first cookbooks to be directed to people doing their own cooking at home rather than to servants cooking for royalty. This begins to trace the evolution of cooking away from, or of cookbooks away from a very luxurious item produced for the upper classes to a cookbook aimed more at the middle class.
So this raises a question, maybe up until very recently, there's been this divide between domestic cooking and professional cooking, and that being, you know, one has largely been the province of men in the professional cooking, versus the idea of cooking as a central act of running a household. So do these historic cookbooks sort of reflect that divide?
Well, there's several things going on here. First of all, much cookery was done by domestic servants. So when you talk about professional cooking, the professionals who were doing the cooking in average homes were the servants. And they could be expected to prepare much more elaborate types of things, even in a relatively humble setting.
when women cook, they may be working as domestics, cooking as a full-time cook or as a maid of all work. They will be taking care of their children, they will be keeping the house clean, they will be working with less time and with cheaper ingredients.
Efficiency becomes a
Well, efficiency issue. Is always a question. It's a huge question in restaurants, it's a huge question in managing your day as a housewife with small children banging into your knees.
Then we have a couple of African-American cookbooks. First, What Mrs. Fisher Knows About Old Southern Cooking, which is a very famous book. Mrs. Fisher was a freed slave who then became a professional cook and won awards for her pickles and preserves and eventually moved to San Francisco and dictated this book because she was illiterate herself.
This book was published in 1881,
and okay. It was printed by a women's cooperative printing office in San Francisco, which is another interesting example of how cookbooks also document women's activities in other ways.
Something else about cookbooks now is that they are a great deal more complicated and expensive and machine-dependent than cookbooks were when I was learning how to cook in the 50s. And an ingredients list on a recipe now may have 25 different things in it. This, and people look at old cookbooks and say, oh, this food was so boring.
I suppose that also shows how access to a variety of ingredients for household cooks has changed quite substantially.
We're not as dependent on what's strictly local anymore. We can get things from all over the world, so we're throwing it all into the pot, as it were. Here are two editions of an Eskimo cookbook that comes from an island off the coast of Alaska, and you can see it here on the map. The island is called Saryshev Island, and it's become pretty well known because this island is one of the first victims of global warming. The island is gradually disappearing under the rising waters. So these recipes that come from this island are recording a vanishing way of life. Some of them call for burying food in the permafrost for 6 months for it to ferment. And all of these things are going to become impossible to do under global warming.
Now that we've had a chance to look at some of the great treasures in the collection here, I guess what I come away with is this curiosity as to what you think cookbooks tell us that we can't actually get from other contemporary sources.
I realized that I was hearing the voices of people whose voices and lives are otherwise not recorded, but we're still hearing what they have to say. And the cookbooks are full of fantasy and practicality and attitude. So it's fun.
So the other day I saw a cartoon in The New Yorker, and it was of a couple standing at the kitchen counter, and it looked as if the woman had an iPad. And the caption was, "Honey, the internet's down, I can't make dinner." Okay? And the reason why I bring that up is we're standing in a room full of these beautiful historic cookbooks, but a lot of people go home, that go to like Epicurious or whatever, and they're looking up things on the web. Do you worry how we're going to continue to document and capture the meaning of food in our lives?
Well, my feeling is that I think there is a convenience element to the quick lookup on the internet, but an individual cookbook will have a point of view or a voice that unites it in some way that you lose completely when you just get miscellaneous recipes off the internet. And the visual aspect, of course, on the internet is not as satisfying. The ability to hold it in your hand and imagine these recipes is something I think people still want. I don't think printed cookbooks are going to go away.
Every time I cook, look like you can't get enough. Fix your pot of soup and make you drink it up. So keep on eating.
Marilyn Altieri is the curator of printed materials at the Schlesinger Library. Barbara Ketchum Wheaton is the honorary curator of the library's spectacular culinary collection. There are pictures of some of these beautiful old cookbooks at our website, radioboston.org.
Keep on eating. Tomorrow on our program, U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz. The Boston Globe named her Bostonian of the Year. We'll talk to her about last year's biggest legal cases, from Whitey Bulger to Beacon Hill corruption.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at Boston.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Keep on eating. Oh, keep on eating.